He's about 455 yards away. He's going to hit about a 2-iron, I think.
This is the School of Motion podcast. Come for the MoGraph, stay for the puns.
Our resilience, our resourcefulness, our ability to understand that events don't shape our lives. How we view or respond to those events can and does often dictate our response. The way we look at something is much more important than what the event is. And so when you look at yourself in a positive light, it changes everything.
There are a lot of things to be afraid of in motion design. Learning new tools, finding the right job, trying to elevate through your entire career. But the one thing that's common to everyone that wakes up in the morning and stares at that blank screen is imposter syndrome. Now, there's been a lot of discussion about what it is and how to stop it, or am I the only person who feels it, or is there something wrong with me if I feel like I might not be the right person to do this job? But very rarely do we actually have conversations with someone who have studied imposter syndrome, who understands what its cause is and how to work with it. That's right, work with it, not defeat it. Today, we're going to talk with Dr. Dave Landers about that dark voice that lives deep in the back of your head. Today, let's figure out what imposter syndrome really is all about. And before we dive right in, let's hear from one of our amazing alumni about their time at School of Motion.
So it's actually insane how much value School of Motion provides in their courses. They're like this sweet art school where you can learn everything you need in a short amount of time. I never expected to learn how to do, you know, rad transitions or even open up Cinema 4D for that matter. YouTube tutorials can only go so far for you, and School of Motion provides you with a structured curriculum and the necessary feedback for creatives to reflect on their own work and improve their skills. I've been a motion designer for 6 years now, and School of Motion seriously elevated my design sense and my eye for animation. I highly recommend it to anyone needing to up their animation chops or learn a new creative program. The resources and the connections you make throughout your time taking a course are so invaluable. It's super rad to see everyone else's progress, and it really feels like a collective where everyone wants to support and uplift each other's work. If you're really serious about animation and design, please check out School of Motion and join this community. My name is Vincent, and I am a School of Motion alumni.
So today, we have an absolute treat. I'm here with Dr. Dave, and we're here to talk about something that's near and dear to my heart. And if you know anything about me, you know that I had a big conversation last year at Camp MoGraph, and I asked three big questions that I don't think people were really expecting to hear me talk about, but they all centered around the mental health of our industry. And the biggest response came from me asking, do you feel imposter syndrome? And not surprisingly, almost every one of you raised your hands. And I think that's okay, because in our industry, we're still in the very first wave of people making through their career. There isn't anybody that's even retired. So in some ways, we kind of are all imposters, but we don't know how to deal with it. We don't know how to define it, and we don't even know how to really talk about it. And that's why today, Dr. Dave, you're here. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, and congratulations for, as a profession, for entertaining this topic.
Well, it's something that I think is sitting right under the surface of so many people. In a world where we're dealing with pandemics and people losing jobs and people going remote and trying to figure out how to balance it, it kind of gets lost in the shuffle, but I think it's sitting right there. And I'd love if you could, just to set the stage, could you just talk a little bit about what imposter syndrome actually is?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So imposter syndrome usually refers to an internal, note, not external, experience of believing you are not as competent as others perceive you to be. Now, while this definition is usually applied to intelligence and achievement, it has links to perfectionism in the social context. To put it simply, it is the experience of your feeling like a phony, a fraud. You feel as though at any moment you're going to be found out as a fraud, like you don't belong where you are, and you only got there through dumb luck. It can and does affect anyone, no matter their social status, their work background, their skill level, or degree of expertise. Now, I want to go back to my initial comment that this refers to an internal experience, as opposed to any external feedback you may receive from peers, supervisors, clients, family members, and/or friends. So these are messages that you give yourself. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're getting them from outside, but this is what you tell yourself. And here are just some of the common signs of imposter syndrome. Self-doubt, an inability to realistically assess your competence and your skills. Attributing your success to external factors. Berating your performance. You're not good enough. Fear that you won't live up to expectations. Overachieving, which is the infamous Wonder Woman Superman complex. Sabotaging your own success. Self-doubt. Setting very challenging goals and feeling disappointed when you fall short. And did I mention self-doubt?
Yes.
So one of the things that's important for us as we go through this conversation, Ryan, is to understand something that I teach all of my students. I always have, and they come back and tell me this was so helpful to them. And that is that labels belong on soup cans. They don't belong on people. And when you put a label on someone, sometimes they then change their behavior to try and fit the label. Mm. And so, you know, I like soup, but I don't happen to like tomato soup. And if I have a cupboard full of soup cans that have no labels and I want soup and I grab a can and it's tomato soup, I'm going to be disappointed. I like chicken noodle soup. So labels belong on soup cans, but we all label people around us and people around us label us. But most importantly here, we label ourselves. So if I label myself as someone who has imposter syndrome, then that can have a real negative impact on who I am and how I view myself. And that's where some of the self-doubt comes in.
That is, I think, the first time I've heard somebody describe it so acutely. And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's a really insidious problem specifically for our industry, because at heart, more than I think almost any other creative arts industry, we are problem solvers looking for the express approval from others, right?
It's right.
For better or worse, motion design is still at its heart defined as a service industry, right? Like we're very rarely making work for ourselves. We're almost always commissioned by someone else. And we define ourselves as successful if someone else thinks we're successful. But what you're telling me is that the imposter syndrome kind of label, it isn't necessarily coming from interactions with other people. It's coming from your interactions with yourself, with your own psyche.
It is. But at the same time, and it's a great question, I find that all industries seem to be equally impacted by the syndrome, although your particular profession may be more susceptible to it simply because so many members of the general public have absolutely no idea or clue of what you do. Mm-hmm. So, question, what does School of Motion even mean? What are motion graphics? And a question for you, can you remember any family member's reaction when you told them that you were going to study film or graphic design or motion graphics?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I know I struggled with just saying that I was an artist for probably over a decade. I would tell people I worked on computers.
Exactly. And so my favorite character, who I hope doesn't really exist, is so when Aunt Tilly asks you over Thanksgiving break as you pass the cranberry sauce, so what are you going to do for a career, for a job? How did she respond when you told her that you were interested in graphic design or motion graphics?
It was complete confusion.
Absolutely. You know, and most people don't have a clue about what this means and what it is. And so because you're not getting that kind of external reinforcement, no one is saying, oh, that's awesome. You know, I've seen these wonderful things on ads and in movies and everything else. That's great. You're going to do that. That's not the reaction that you get. You know, I met this past weekend with a former student of mine. He brought his 18-year-old son up to Champlain College in Burlington, and he's going to study film. So his son, Mick, was a high school athlete, and he was good, but he wasn't great. And he was a good student, but not great. And so his father said, what do you want to do? And he goes, I want to do film. And he took a couple of film classes in high school and really loved it. Now, his father's a businessman. And his son says, I want to go and study film. And his father says to me, fortunately, he didn't say it to his son, I'm going to spend $200,000 on my son's college education, and he's going to get a degree in film. And then what's he going to do with it? He's not going to get a job when he graduates. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, he told me that, but he didn't tell his son that. He said to his son, fine, do some research, find a good school, and we'll support you 100%. But it is that uncertainty about what we're talking about when we talk about whether it's a school of motion or it's graphic design or anything like that. And it's interesting because now that as an industry, you're starting to look at this and start to ask the questions, then the next question is, where do we go from here once people start asking those questions?
Yeah, that's the kind of mystery, I think, for everyone in our industry, is that we've maybe crossed the first hurdle of knowing that it's there, but We don't know the nature of it. We don't know where it comes from. And then I don't think we know how to treat it. I mean, I think there's been just the beginnings of discussions of, is this something that you can conquer? Is this something that you manage? Is this something that you have to have your radar up for all the time? Are there triggers that, you know, we can be on the lookout for? You know, all of those questions are kind of just circling in the air, but nobody really has any good answers yet.
Yeah. And of course, those are great questions. So I find it fascinating. I find your industry fascinating. And I find it particularly fascinating that you want to talk about this because it's been around since the mid to late 70s. And that was when the expression was first coined. I've encountered it through my counseling and my teaching experience. But a great question is to where does it come from? The most current thinking is that while originated primarily with women who had for years and years and years been told directly and indirectly that they were not good enough, not thin enough, not attractive enough, not smart enough, their hair was too curly, not curly enough, it was too kinky or not kinky enough, their skin was too light or too dark, their bodies and or specifically their breasts were too big or too small. Now that's changed. And now men too are subject to the not good enough scenarios that our culture surrounds us with. Men are not cut enough, not masculine enough, not strong enough. Their penises are too big or not big enough. It's interesting to note here that everyone can benefit from better understanding and accepting ourselves for who we are and knowing that, in fact, we are good enough. But we have a world and a culture that tells us 24/7, 365, you're not good enough. Mm-hmm. And when your reinforcement comes from external sources like a client, you know, so a client comes to you and says, here's my idea. You're the expert. Go ahead and do this and get it done in a day and a half. And so you spend hours and hours and hours working on a project and the client may say, oh, okay, that's good. Or no, that's not good. So that reinforcement is so important and we all need that and we all thrive on it. But I think particularly in your industry, because you're the folks who have a set of skills that that the rest of us don't have. I mean, artists and people who are in this profession are incredibly gifted. But if you don't get reinforcement from the people around you that you are gifted and that what you're doing is amazing, that's where the self-doubt comes in.
So going forward then, what do you think are some actionable tools that artists can actually start to adopt? I mean, I think in my mind, you know, I've suffered from this greatly. And it felt like every time I conquered a stage or a level in my career, it kind of would subside. But then the next time I would engage to try to make it to the next level or try to get to the next best studio, it felt like I was receding all the way back to that starting line again. And it was, oh man, they're going to understand that I don't know what I'm talking about. They're going to see right through me. I have a blank page. I'm frozen. And no matter how many times, I mean, I was working for 10 years before I made it to the studio of my dreams. And the first 3 months at that studio was a living nightmare, if I could be totally honest, because I woke up every morning thinking they're going to realize it. They're going to kick me out and they're going to tell everyone else. And I'm never going to work in the industry again. And that's not hyperbole. That is the honest truth.
No, absolutely. And that impacts so many people. But if you think about this for a second, so a positive and accurate self-assessment, I'll go back and repeat that. A positive and accurate self-assessment can be very helpful for anyone, but especially for those who experience the imposter syndrome. So what are your strengths? What are you really good at? Mm-hmm. Do you have a close friend, a partner, or a coworker with whom you can have this kind of discussion? That happened, from what I understand, at Camp MoGraph.
Yes.
Can you do an accurate assessment? The imposter syndrome is not healthy, as it leads to issues of depression and anxiety. And let me define anxiety. Anxiety is defined as issues of fear and apprehension. It manifests itself in us cognitively with our thoughts, I'm not good enough, for example. Somatically with our body reacting to something, sweaty palms, increased heart rate, increased blood pressure, or behaviorally. And behaviorally, this is where we avoid situations that may cause us the anxiety. And when you think about the link between anxiety and depression, and depression is often defined as anger turned inward. Well, that anger is anger at yourself. You know, why didn't I know how to do this correctly? Why didn't I know what the latest technology was? Why didn't I read another article in another magazine at 2 o'clock in the morning after I finished a project? Mm-hmm. So you go through that more so than a lot of other professions because that perfectionism also comes into play. So if you think about the idea that there is an expectation that you give yourself and sometimes others give you that you have to be perfect. It has to be just right. It has to be so good. And that's, you know, that's really difficult. And so when you think about the idea of perfectionism in your field, you're the experts. A client comes to you, they have an idea of what they want, but it's your job to take that idea and make it come to life. But if you look at that and go, you know, I could have tweaked that a little bit differently. Your client doesn't know that because your client doesn't have the skills. If the client had the skills, they would have done it themselves. Mm-hmm. So, and I think, you know, the tie-in, you know, between the imposter syndrome and your profession also fits into athletics. And I've done a lot of work with athletes. Mm-hmm. I was the NCAA faculty athletics rep for 13 years at St. Michael's College. So I was a liaison between athletics and academics. So I worked with all 21 varsity teams. But if you think about someone in your profession who's an elite artist, and then you think about an elite athlete, think about Michael Phelps. Michael Phelps is probably the best swimmer we've ever had and probably that we ever will have. If Michael Phelps had not been arrested, hadn't gotten a second DUI, he probably would be dead today because he was experiencing depression, but he couldn't tell anybody. Mm-hmm. And so he knew that the previous Olympics, he'd gotten X number of medals. And now the expectation that everybody had was he had to do better than that. And then he had to do better than that and better than that. And he had to do faster. Even though he was getting older, he had to get better than what he was. And you just can't do that. But there's no one to say to him, it's okay. You're okay. So when he got arrested for the DUI, the judge forced him to go into counseling. And he now promotes on television a lot, people going to get counseling. The other person, you know, I was watching the Boston Red Sox play against Atlanta last night. And Jerry Remy is one of the announcers. And they were in the studio and they were talking. And they were talking about the young players today, the professional athletes, and how good they are. And Jerry said, I was never that good. Hmm. And Dennis Eckerle said, I was never that good. And Dave O'Brien turns to Jerry Remy and goes, Jerry, You had a series of 19 games that you had a hit in. You're still saying that you didn't feel you were good enough? He goes, no, I kept waiting for the hammer to come down and someone to say you're not good enough. So the parallel between any profession that expects you to be perfect and what you do in terms of the art world and motion design and graphic design, that puts a tremendous, tremendous burden on you.
I'm so glad you brought that up because I've kind of tried to urge to artists that I talk to start to consider themselves at the same level as an elite athlete, because what we're doing is so rare. It requires constant practice and constant upkeep and a constant kind of sense of where you stand compared to everyone else. And there's also just this general sense of being really used to and comfortable with failure as a way to get better. But in our industry, everybody is tiptoeing like they have to hit a home run every time they come up to bat. And it's just not sustainable.
And who gives them permission to say, that's okay? And no, again, one. that goes to the not good enough. Mm-hmm. You know, and when you look at the not good enough, you know, complex, which hits everybody, you know, if you're saying to yourself, this isn't good enough, it may be fine. It may be absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. And a couple things to think about. And this is pretty bizarre. 40% of adults today are dealing with mental and behavioral health issues. Hmm. And the pandemic has only made that worse. Mm-hmm. Most of those people will not get help. A quarter of the young people ages 18 to 25 have considered suicide.
Wow.
And the suicide rate is rising. Mm-hmm. 13% of adults in the pandemic right now report an increasing substance use to try and cope with this pandemic. And a couple of years ago, there were two men's ice hockey players, Danny and Justin. And Danny had gone through some depression, and he talked with the coach about it because it was impacting his grades. He was a four-point student. And the coach got him to see one of the counselors on campus, which was great. And then Justin had an uncle who'd committed suicide. And then he had a friend that he went to college with, or who went to high school with, who was in college, who disappeared right after Christmas. And everybody was pretty sure he was gone. And they discovered his body in May that year. And these two guys came to me and they said, can we do something to use our status as athletes, as student athletes, to try and deal with athletes about mental health issues? Mm-hmm. And I said, yes. I said, you know, and we were meeting with the woman who was the women's basketball coach and also the advisor for the Student Athletic Advisory Council. I said, let's come up with all the things we want to work on. We can't work on everything. To pick three topics we can deal with. The three topics they picked, everybody picked the same ones: depression, anxiety, and suicide. And these guys started a program called Hope Happens Here. And they started doing presentations at athletic events. And so we started having male athletes talking about suicide, talking about anxiety, talking about depression. And then we got the female athletes to be part of it. So trying to give people permission to deal with topics that no one's comfortable talking about, that's essential. And then, you know, there are a couple of other ideas of how you can get past that sense of the imposter syndrome. One is, you know, the people who are listening to this podcast, you have a tremendous amount of skills. Can you volunteer those skills to a local nonprofit? So you may look at an internet thing on a nonprofit that's trying to get some support for, you know, for youth at risk or whatever that may be. And you look at their, you know, look at their website or look at their videos and you go, I could change that. Mm-hmm. I could make that better. Do you volunteer for that? Because if you do, then you have a chance to feel better about yourself. Another thing to do is to realize that our resilience, our resourcefulness, our ability to understand that events don't shape our lives. How we view or respond to those events can and does often dictate our response. I'm reading an interesting book called How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram X. Kendi. And in the book, he says this, quote, what could happen based on my deepest fears mattered more than what did happen to me. I believed violence was stalking me, but in truth, I was being stalked inside my own head. And once we realize that the self-talk, if it's negative, is only going to hurt us, and it's only going to take us down that road of anxiety, fear and apprehension, and depression. Then think about our friends, our family, our close friends, our colleagues, our institutions. They can be a source of strength. Here's another one. Get off of Facebook and Twitter. You know, my friend Kim just did her dissertation, got her PhD, and I was a content editor for it, and she did it on Facebook. Mm. And it's the first time that we've had some actual data to look at the fact that the more people are on Facebook, the more the level of depression, the more level of anxiety, and the least level of satisfaction with life. Because what does Facebook do? Facebook makes you compare yourself to somebody else. Because everybody puts up on Facebook the way we want people to see us, not necessarily the way that we are. Another suggestion is to Zoom or FaceTime or Skype with those you love and those people who support you. Talk about your concerns. Share what we're talking about on the podcast. Talk about what your concerns are for yourself, for your friends, for your colleagues, so that you are not carrying all of that weight solely on your shoulders. Zoom with colleagues. Zoom with colleagues that you value who are going through the same uncertainty as you are, as all of us are, about the realities of life across the world, especially now with the pandemic. And they can really help you realize and accept that you are not alone in this journey. And if we think that we're alone in this journey, that's where the problems come. And if we think we can't talk to somebody, so what I hope this podcast does, Ryan, is to give people permission to say, yep, Ryan's right. This is what I've been dealing with. And I haven't been able to talk about it before, but now I am. And what you experienced at Camp MoGraph is something that your students and the students at the School in Motion can start to deal with and recognize you are good enough. And so let's start dealing with it in a positive way.
That's wonderful. I mean, I have listened to everything you say, and it really feels like what's resonating with me is that it's very easy to get lost into isolation, and the pressures mount and double down when you allow yourself to be in that position.
And absolutely,
one of the actionable things we can all take from listening to this is that not just waiting until it gets to a crisis point to reach out to someone, but to make it part of your active daily life as a working artist to break free from the isolation, whether it's a colleague, whether it's someone that you went to school with, whether it's a loved one, whether it's a group of people that meet together regularly, making that part of your daily or weekly practice as much as learning a new tutorial or, you know, looking for more work if you're a freelancer, like that has to be part of your daily practice.
It has to be. I have two friends who are really being challenged by teaching in the current environment, mm-hmm. You know, because, and one of my friends teaches down at Merrimack College, and he's got a podium on wheels with plastic sheeting on the both sides and on the front. And he can move his podium around, but the students can't move.
Right.
And then he has another class where he's got 30 students in an auditorium, but he's got four of them doing online. He's got five of them are quarantined because of Corona, and the rest of them are sitting in a classroom. Now, how do you deal with all of that? So we've been friends for a long time, and I've been a mentor to both of them. Every Thursday afternoon, we Zoom for an hour just to talk about what's going on. How are you? How's the wife? How are the kids? How's your husband doing? What are the kids up to? Because it gives them an opportunity just to process things. See, Ryan, when we keep everything inside, We only listen to ourselves. Mm-hmm. When we have a chance to share what's going on in our concerns and our fears and our worries, as well as, man, I just did this great project and it went really well and the client loved it. We've got to be able to share that, because if we don't, then it just sits there and we pay a price for that.
Yes, I think I want people to really listen to that, because the other unique kind of issue with our industry is that we do so much good work and so much hard work and put so much time into something that is essentially ephemeral, right? The amount of time and effort that it takes for an ad on TV or a pre-roll for a YouTube video to actually be created versus the life that it lives, it's almost gone before you actually finish it. And then there's no resonance.
Exactly.
That work doesn't connect to people that someone, you know, 3 months later can say, oh, do you remember that piece? Unlike music or film or TV, you know, where a lot of other creatives are working, there is that resonance with your work connecting to an audience that we are kind of robbed of in a daily experience. And even more so now, because you don't have that happy accident of a coworker walking by and saying, oh, that's great, how did you do that? Or explain to me. We're just staring at our screens in this very myopic worldview of just like, I have a problem, I have to solve it. If I can't, I'm going to get fired. I think it's really important for everyone to hear what you just said.
It is. And I want to go back to the reinforcement thing, because, you know, as a psychology professor, I used to talk with all of my students and I would say to them, if you're looking for immediate reinforcement, don't go into the field of psychology. Because you're not going to have somebody come back the next day and say, wow, you really changed my life by that conversation yesterday. Right. But I've been doing this longer than most of the people listening to this have been alive. You know, I'm 76 right now and I'm retired and I love it. I hear from students all the time. And I've had students come back and say, you saved my life. And that was 20 years ago. Or people have said, I haven't told you this forever, but I've always wanted to, and now I'm going to. So, you know, where do you get your reinforcement from? Sometimes it's from your clients, but it's also got to be from inside you.
I think this was a question I wanted to ask, but I think you kind of just gave a hint at the answer. You know, a lot of the people listening to this, they're not just people who have recently graduated or people that work for someone else. They're also people who are starting their own companies or may have a small company already. And I think that's where a lot of the responsibility and power to change this for our industry may be coming from, that if you know your employees or your coworkers are isolated, it's kind of upon all of us in this position to create an environment where people can get that recognition and get that reinforcement and have it be something that is, again, part of your studio culture. Do you think that that's something that could be a takeaway that people can pull from this, that we're not just asking each individual to go and take the responsibility, but also for those of us who employ and connect people, it's part of our responsibility as well.
I agree with you. And I think that's one of the reasons why you asked me to do this podcast and why Mark gave you my name, because it's important as a profession that you give people permission to understand it's not all on your shoulders. And a couple of other things. One is I'm wearing a t-shirt right now and it says, you are loved. And, you know, I wear that. I have several of them and I wear it. And the response I get from people is amazing. The other thing to understand is it's okay to not be okay. I mean, it's okay to have some self-doubt, but then how do you deal with it? And if it's something that's been bothering you for a while, find a good therapist. I mean, there's some wonderful, wonderful therapists who are out there right now, and just find someone to talk to. Or again, talk with a trusted colleague or a trusted friend and say, this is what I'm going through. What do you think? But it's so important for us not to be an island unto ourselves. And again, an artist who has a specific set of skills may work in isolation to get that project done. Once the project is done, they have to find a way to share that project with other people. So that's where they can get that positive feedback and the positive reinforcement.
Mm-hmm. I think that's great advice. And I think we have an epidemic of people getting overburdened by seeing so much amazing work all the time. It's an endless flow, an endless stream. But I think it's very comparable to what you're talking about with people with Facebook, where you're not seeing the sketchbook full of bad sketches. You're not seeing all of the project files of things that were broken. You just see this endless stream because the entire world is out there trying to show off that you just see the good stuff. But I want to ask you a question, because I think this is part of the problem is that I talk a lot in this course about having a voice and trying to create some sort of vision for yourself, for your career and your future, because I think we lose, again, because it's so easy for us to be so narrow focused and myopic on the day-to-day problem solving that we lose sense of like the context to why we got started. And a lot of us don't even have a definition of what a successful career would or could look like. Do you have any tips or any kind of ideas on just gaining a better perspective to what you're doing day to day, so you don't get lost in the troubles of the small, narrow issues and still keep the rest of your goals or your vision in mind?
Yeah. And I love the concept of giving someone a voice. Mm-hmm. And if you look, and let's take this, we'll stay away from both politics, but if you take what's going on across the country, there are people who are begging for a voice. They're begging to be heard. And I think to be able to say, this is my voice now, how do I express that? If you ask people, you know, what got you into this field in the first place? The artistic bent on someone is that I've got this thing that I've got to do. Mm-hmm. You know, and so my friend, you know, who just brought his son up to study film, you know, he's a businessman. He just started a company 10 years ago. He's got 1,000 employees, and I'm sure he probably wanted his son, you know, to go into the business. His son has this driving force. I love film and I want to go into film. Mm-hmm. And how do we give permission for people to do that and to say, that's okay, that's fine. But then once you do come up with something, how do you expand that worldview so that it isn't just you and the client? So Mark Sunozzi every once in a while will post something that he's done, a creative thing on Facebook, and I'm absolutely blown away with it. Every time he does it, I make sure that I respond and I make sure that I say, Mark, that's awesome. That's just fantastic. And when someone takes that risk of putting something on Facebook or putting something on Instagram, it's a risk, but there can also be some really good rewards. And so getting out of yourself, and again, I'll go back to volunteering to do something to help people in your community, you know, help a school or something like that, and say, well, let me try and do it a little different way without looking for any kind of, you know, money, monetary, you know, payment for anything like that, but just saying, let me do something to help out the bigger community. And that's where the voice comes from.
I mean, I think that's incredible because I think we forget the idea that what we do, what our skills are capable of, and what our end product shows has incredible value. But the people that we try to get work from, it's in their best interest to diminish that value, right?
Yes.
Clients are, part of their job is to make it seem like what we're doing isn't as valuable so they can get more of it. But the truth is, they desperately need it. They want to be close to it. They feel the heat coming off of what we can do. And honestly, a lot of them wish they could do it. And I love the idea of what you're saying, though, is that take what you can do and teach yourself what the true value is by separating yourself from that power structure of somebody trying to get what you can do for less money.
Yes.
The moment you go to someone who needs something that you offer and you can open their eyes or expand their audience or explain what they do better than they ever could, the reaction there and the kind of long-standing kind of reaction, not just that temporary ephemeral hit of releasing a commercial and seeing it disappear, that I hope can help people understand and reinforce how valuable their skills really are and give them the confidence to look at the bigger picture. That I struggle with this a lot. The only way right now that we interact with the world with our skills is to get paid to do something that disappears. But I really think what we have the capability to do, and it may not be for everyone, is something so, so much more.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I am so in awe of the work that you do because I have no artistic ability whatsoever, you know, and I'm a really good teacher. I worked really, really hard at my profession. I did it for a long time. I think I was successful at it. But when it comes to doing something artistic, I have no clue whatsoever. And I was just saying a little bit earlier, it's like, you know, I had an electrician at my house a couple of weeks ago and, you know, he's trying to explain things. And I said, you're the expert. When it comes to anything like this, I was a really good psychology professor. when it comes to artwork and, you know, if I need something artistically done, I know the people to go to, and the clients know that too. And so the artists have to go, well, why is this person coming to me? They're coming to me because I have more skills than they do. And they may be jealous of what I can do because they can't do it, but I've got the skills to do it. And that makes me good enough.
Right. I think that's a lesson for people, right? That there's work you need to do internally to understand how to have the confidence that's waiting for you.
Absolutely.
It's waiting for you to take it. And I see it so often in all of the creative arts industries. I worked in visual effects, and that industry has been ravaged by people not having the confidence to understand the leverage that they actually have.
The other thing to be careful of, and go back to when we first started talking, you know, in terms of labels, if people in your profession start saying, well, I have imposter syndrome, you've now basically said to yourself, there's something wrong with me. I'm broken. I have this thing. I'm a fraud. I'm an imposter. I have this thing called a syndrome. No, there's nothing wrong with you. Mm-hmm. You're talented. You know, you've got great skills. You know, you're loved by a lot of people and people, you know, love the work that you do. But if you buy into, oh my God, I've got imposter syndrome, then you start right down the rabbit hole that sometimes is really, really hard to get out of.
Mm-hmm. I love that idea of kind of always having your radar up and understanding that it's a thing that comes to you, but if you're aware of it, you can manage it and you can work with it. It's not a label or a weight that gets dropped on you. That's something that you're hoping never shows up, right? Like I think a lot of times people think of it as like, oh, I hope I don't have it. I hope I don't have it. And then you find out you do. And they're like, oh, now I'm stuck with this for the rest of my life. It's the next baseball getting thrown to you. It's part of the daily challenge of living as a creative artist working professionally. And we need to take some of your advice on how to address it when it does come up and be aware of it, but it's not something to be feared. It's not something to be lamented.
And a final thing, and I hope people carry this, you know, our resilience, our resourcefulness, our ability to understand that events don't shape our lives. How we view or respond to those events can and does often dictate our response. The way we look at something is much more important than what the event is. And so when you look at yourself in a positive light, it changes everything.
Dr. Dave, that is wonderful. I have a feeling we will be doing a follow-up and you might actually get some calls from some other people asking to talk about this. But thank you. Thank you so much. It's a conversation that's been sitting there under the surface and whispered from some people, but getting this out in the open and getting people to understand that it is okay and it's part of the daily life and there are ways to actively approach it. Hopefully this will be a bigger conversation that lasts for much longer. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
You're welcome, Ryan. Take care.
It's so important that this is just the beginning of this discussion about imposter syndrome and the whole multitude of mind games we all deal with as working motion designers. When there's an endless array of things to learn and what seems like an infinite amount of people entering the industry, seemingly competing with us every single day, there's a lot to worry about. There's a lot to be concerned about. But as Dr. Dave showed us, just having awareness that these are events that do not define us, but the way we react to them is the key to dealing with things like imposter syndrome. It's such a big insight. And to be honest, it's just the very beginning of this type of conversation. Thank you so much. I know this is a very different conversation. If you liked what you heard here, please check out Level Up. It's a free course that we put together that this podcast is actually pulled from. And we talk about all kinds of topics like this that aren't your day-to-day conversations that we have about tools and techniques and studios we all want to work at. It's more about thinking about where you're at and how to figure out where you want to go and setting yourself out on the path to get there. So take a look at that. But until then, thank you as always. Thank you, Dr. Dave, for your time. And we will always be here to help show you new paths, illuminate different tools and tips and tricks that you can use to get further down that path and always show you new people to be excited about. So until next time, thanks and peace.